Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today's podcast is all about mental preparation for stressful events, and I want to start off with a quote. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Mike Tyson said that, and it's a pretty good quote, and it's something that I use a lot when I talk to students and to colleagues about mental preparation, because really, that's a lot of what everything's about. Everyone always has this plan until something goes awry. Mental preparedness is not taught to us in emergency medicine or in healthcare generally, but it is something we all are doing to a degree. However, we need to improve our abilities and expand on them to do our jobs even better. And there are many different approaches, and everyone has their own style, but we will go over some approaches today that will help improve your shifts and hopefully lead to you being a better clinician. Anyone can work on mental preparedness. This can be the new grad EMT all the way to the experienced physician. Universally, though, in medicine, we spend more time working than we actually do training. Think about world-class athletes for a second. More than 99% of their time is devoted to practice, with less than 1% actually devoted to performance. In medicine, we totally flip that. Basically, we complete some training with CMEs and stuff like that. And we gain our experience in the field, but that's not in a safe or controlled environment. Some specialties may have a little more time to practice, but in the end, we're not using the vast amount of our time to actually practice these skills. Now, how do we improve when most of our time is devoted to work? Educational opportunities like classes and training events certainly do help, but a mental model can push us a little bit further. We've talked about this recently when we were discussing how you should be a resuscitationist, and we talked about how the mind is a simulator unlike any other because of the infinite possibilities and the way we can change scenarios as we desire and we can build off of them and everything else. High fidelity simulation is excellent, but it's costly and not available in the downtime periods such as the middle of a dead shift or just before a case comes in. So although high-fidelity simulation is great and we should use it whenever possible, we have to keep in mind that it is the exception to the rule and that really a lot of what we should be doing is based on simply what we can think of on our own and use our mind to build around that. Let us practice using that simulator for a second with a brief scenario. Imagine you have a patient who requires a chest tube for a pneumothorax. You've already resuscitated them and have already stabilized them, but your heart's still pounding from everything. Your stress, everything's a slight blur, and you open a kit and pieces are everywhere. It is a skill you've practiced before, but you're overwhelmed. You just simply cannot take everything going on. You are overwhelmed. It is too much. What could you have done to improve this situation? Well, mental preparation is a key to this, and it's often overlooked. That's the whole reason why we're talking about it today. Like I said, our mind as a simulator can help improve so much of this. Really, we could have solved this whole issue through a series of steps which we're about to talk about. Now, we may not always have chest tube kits available for us to practice with, but in our heads, we can review the steps. Review what is usually in that kit, so think about that for a second. Hopefully, you've used your kit enough, or maybe you have a kit available where you can look at it. Maybe you can just take a picture of it. Usually, you can even find stuff online if you know the exact kit. And what you should do is open that kit up, take a look at it. Remember where everything's at. For example, with me on central lines, I'm pretty sure I can tell you where everything is at in the kit in my mind right now without having anything in front of me. That is how we should be practicing this. Get the basics down first. Understand what that kit looks like, where everything is, and don't even just think about where the kit physically is and where all the little pieces are. Take that one step further. Where's the kit in the room? Where are the extras outside the room? Because they may be stored in some sort of storage system, such as an OmniCell. Find where all that's at. Think about all that. That's the first, most basic step. Think about all those needed pieces, and then consider what you would do as a replacement for each one of those pieces if they weren't there. Troubleshoot what happens if something gets dropped. Or maybe there's not something that's in the kit that should be there. Run through every complication of the procedure and of the tools and whatever else. You can even talk about this in a group setting, which can promote teamwork. think about it like this. You could talk about this with your nursing and other providers around, and basically everyone can be in the same idea of, well, this is how we like the kit set up. So everyone's on the same page on how kits should be set up. And then maybe other people are going to have previous experiences where they said, you know, I've used this a lot, I don't like it. Or maybe I've used this, I found that if you use a certain piece instead, you'll find this works even better. Talk about this out loud. Use everyone's experiences. It should not just be your experience that you have to base things off of. Build off of everyone in the room when you have such discussions. Now, there are some key principles we tend to forget about or maybe don't even know exist that adds to the mental preparation in stressful situations. The Unified Model of Stress and Performance discusses how different conditions or zones, depending on how you look at it, affect performance. Now, condition yellow or red can be beneficial and somewhat desired, really, in most situations, but as our heart rate increases into the gray or black conditions, our performance deteriorates rather rapidly. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this concept, so let me explain this to you a little bit further. I'm going to kind of run through this basically, but think of it like this. Your body reacts basically in different heart rate zones, roughly. And based on that is what we are able to do skill-wise. Now, condition white, that's like a resting heart rate. That's us in happy, joyful la-la land. When I was training in MMA all the time, one of my instructors always talked about how really outside of the peace of our home, and maybe not even then, you know, maybe it's just when we sleep, we're in condition white. You know, we really need to stay kind of somewhat alert and somewhat awake, especially in a shift like what we do. We're probably living most of the time in condition yellow, especially in a busy shift. You know, condition yellow is when our heart rate's up, you know, probably in the 90s, a little bit of hundreds kind of range. Our fine motor skills start to deteriorate a little bit, but usually we're able to do most procedures okay. And we can usually correct that as we need to. But condition yellow is a lot of times where we want to be. Now, condition red is when our heart rate starts to elevate, usually around the 120s plus range. And this is actually where we start to lose gross motor skills. This becomes a bit of an issue, but most of the time for skills such as intubation, we're okay with this. We can safely do this because of the gross movements that we're doing. Now, we may not be very good at an IND or a laceration repair with our hands starting to shake a little bit or stuff like that. And so we'll need to work about how to calm that down. And I'll cover that in just a second. But then we start getting to what's called condition gray. Our heart rate's starting to get in the 150s. You know, for someone who's healthy, that should be already starting to push up where we should be in a more stressful environment, such as running or things like that. This is when our actual cognitive processes start to deteriorate. And you may notice this, the tunnel vision starts getting worse. And when we start getting tunnel vision, we're losing our depth perception, we're not actually seeing as clearly, and we can even exclude a lot of auditory sounds. If you think for a second about Saving Private Ryan, great movie for a couple of reasons, because it includes some things, especially in that opening scene where it talks about auditory exclusion. He can't hear things. He's got a very narrow focus, all this stuff. He's basically in condition gray right now, and almost to the point probably where he's almost a condition black. In condition black, we never really want to be there, especially in emergency medicine. That's a bad place to be because we are now going on instincts. Our heart rate's in the 170s plus, and basically we're in a fight, flight, or fright mode. I think of it like this way because really with some people, we're going to freeze up, or fright is another way to think of it. But we start getting into a submissive behavior. And this can even be the point where you start voiding bowel or bladder uncontrollably. This is, again, a zone we never want to be in. And if we start getting in condition gray, we want to get out of this as quickly as possible, down to red or even yellow, depending on what the situation demands and what we're available to do to us. So how do we get out of condition gray, or how do we get from condition red down to yellow, or whatever the case may be? How do we slow things down? And the most simple way to do this is with an approach called tactical breathing. There's all different versions of tactical breathing. I've heard about three or four by now, but the one I like the most is that you want to take a deep breath in for 3 to 4 seconds, and then you need to hold it for 3 to 4 seconds, and then you exhale for 3 to 4 seconds, and then optionally you can hold out for 3 to 4 seconds. This is also known as box breathing or triangle breathing, with the main difference being that holding out for 3 to 4 seconds. Now, the easiest way I've heard about it is the rule of fours, where basically 4 seconds in, hold for 4 seconds, 4 seconds out, hold out for 4 seconds, and do that 4 times. The idea is that if you do this breathing in a rotation 4 times, basically you only take 4 breaths that minute. And what that does is it really helps slow your heart rate down. Easy way to do this, get into some sort of stressful environment. Just go for like a couple of laps around a track or something like that. Just do something that's going to bring your heart rate up. And then stop and do that breathing. And you can even try this other times. And I've even had patients do this a lot. The most common example of when I use this, and this is just all anecdotal, but it seems to work well with patients, have them in a stressful or painful procedure, like when I'm doing a local anesthetic, like I'm injecting the lidocaine in for an IND or a laceration repair, I tell them to do this breathing. And this, I don't call it tactical breathing or anything like that. I just tell them, hey, we're going to slow down your breathing. This is how I want you to do it. Patients do that and they calm down almost instantly most of the time. And usually I can get them basically talked down from the ledge almost, because they are able to slow down that heart rate and they go from a condition gray to a condition red to yellow even. And that's what I want them to do. I want to help calm them down. And it's amazing how much it also improves their pain response to this. Another issue that we described in this scenario is what's called Hicks' Law. And basically the issue with Hicks' Law is that if we provide someone with different options and we make all these options available to them, the time for decision takes longer and longer, basically on a logarithmic scale. And we want to avoid that if possible. In the case with chest tubes, take out all the multiple choices of the types of chest tubes or the tools you can use or stuff like that. Limit it as much as possible, or leave no options at all. You could create a uniformed approach, and by cutting down that complexity, you cut down the time and you cut down on the mental stress that the person who's performing the procedure will have to go through. Make it uniformed each time. Think about checklists, basically, for example. We should, for most things, do it one way each time. Leave it to the experts, and even with the experts, we need to be careful about expanding off of it. So essentially, Hicks' Law is to keep things simplified. Leave it to one or two choices, but keep it as basic as possible. Checklists also have the benefit of providing that cognitive offloading. In the chest tube scenario that we're talking about, by confirming all the pieces are there on a checklist prior to ever starting, basically saves you from having to handle an additional stressor during an already complex event. It also ensures that you're complying with that Hicks Law point of staying true to one method, because basically you have someone else who's saying, no, 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 this is how we need to do it this way. Now, sometimes, of course, you may have to use an alternative route, maybe because something's not available or because in this situation it's not appropriate, but we should truly limit that as much as possible, because once we start going off the checklist, we're getting to that Hicks Law scenario. So I find these two are very relevant to one another. And also, by using a checklist, this promotes team cohesion. And basically, the people who are using the checklist can keep on the same system every single time and don't have to modify for different people. Stress inoculation is another important point, and it's really one of those you got to train like you play. And for me, when we talk about this, we're really not training in isolation. A lot of times we are doing it with the basic skills. For me, this is all important when we talk about, for example, IOs and with students. So when I have students, I try and universally teach them on a series of skills. And one of my favorites to teach them is IOs, because I teach them to do it the same way every single time. Every student goes through it. If at all possible, we go through it several times. And what I do is I make sure they master the basics first. This is how you put on the IO. This is how you control it. This is all the steps to it. And as it gradually grows, I make it more and more complex. And within 30 minutes, they're usually to the point where they can handle the stress of constant questioning and distractions, all while being able to safely and consistently place that IO without any sort of complication. Stress inoculation plays a vital role in emergency medicine training because it provides a safe barrier practice and allows for us to grow off of that. Norman Schwarzkopf has frequently been attributed with the quote, "The more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war." And I like the quote. It's a very good way to say basically that we need to sweat more. We need to actually be sweating more in the sense of we need to train with stress. Again, stress inoculation is one part of that, but it's even more. And think about something you can even do at home real quick. Do something that increases your heart rate. Again, this doesn't have to be in a controlled environment such as when you're practicing the IO. This could simply be you go out for a run, and while your heart rate's up, think about all these different things. Even better, get a friend to run with you, and as you're running together, ask each other questions back and forth. Increase the complexity with time and just push each other a little bit further. The more you train, the better you'll get at it. And we'll talk about that more here in a second, but essentially, what I want you to do is train more and more and more and train in more difficult settings. Again, the more you sweat with this, the more complex you get, the more you challenge yourself, the better you're going to get at this. Now, sometimes one of the most important parts of mental preparation in stressful events is realizing that we have limitations. Again, we've already talked about condition gray and how tunnel vision is a real problem and it gets worse with task saturation. Redundancy can help reduce errors by having people who can observe from a distance. An example I like to use is that in codes, usually it's nice to have someone who's kind of standing off to the side, that one person who can observe everything from the door. They listen, but never touch. They're simply there kind of as the person in the background. And you still have that primary person who's running the code, but think about that person may still miss things going on because they're going to get their own tunnel vision. They're going to get their own auditory exclusion to a certain degree. They may be thinking about what they want to do next and not hearing what someone else is suggesting. By having someone off to the side, it allows for more complete monitoring of the room and able to promote ideas outside of those that are already mentioned and could have been missed. And the way I like to think of this is a lot of times I go into a code, you know, a physician may be running the code. I stand off to the side. I kind of observe. I may do my own thing to a degree. And we bounce ideas off of each other. But part of it is because we're both standing off to the side at the same time, but also having hands-on different times. You can even do it that way. But ultimately, you want to have someone who's going to be basically the second chair there. Another great way I've thought of this before, and I've noticed this as I was kind of working through this podcast, it made me think of it again. With some fire departments that I've worked with or have dealt with, they are big enough and their systems well established that they actually have this kind of command post set up for situations. And what happens is that the fire chief or whoever's the incident commander is in one location. And then there is a second person who stands right next to them. It may be the assistant chief or a lieutenant, whatever the case is. They're that second person who's going to be the direct assistant to the IC. And what happens is that the IC is looking at the scenario. So he's standing out in the front yard or wherever the case may be, looking at the whole scenario and also listening to the radios. And that's his only job. He's listening to that and he's going to give his commands off of that. Now, the firefighter who may be walking up to notify him of something or to check on a certain situation or command or whatever doesn't actually go to the IC, the chief. Instead, he's going to go to the second in command there. And what happens is the second in command filters everything. He's the guy who's basically off to the side. And what he's doing is listening, deciding what's important to actually go to the chief or what he can manage himself. And by doing it this way, this allows for the chief to focus on the skills and the tasks that have to be performed and allows for the second in command to also share command, but providing that important filter there that's going to help keep things in check. Archilochus said, "We don't rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training." Even though we have said it several times already, it is worth saying it once more. Mental preparedness is all about the training. If we do not train, we will have nowhere to fall to when it comes to a difficult situation. Training is not just in a classroom or during a course. Mental models are a large part, but it is not everything. We need to train in a stressful environment and sweat more. Simplifying our approach to complex tests, cognitive offloading, and tactical breathing are all vital to mentally prepare for stress. But again, if we do not train, if we do not work to that, just because we have the heroic situation doesn't mean we're actually going to do well. When people talk about this, and I see this a lot myself, both in medicine and firefighting, for example, and also with MMA, all those types of things, I have noticed in myself and in others that the more we train in a specific task, the better we do that when things go to hell, that we're going to actually do better with it. And I've noticed this in all sorts of things. With MMA especially, a lot of it is learning and growing off of basic concepts and developing skills. But some things I'm going to have practiced literally thousands of times. I practice the same punch thousands of times. I've practiced the same disarms thousands of times. And the reason why is because it's not that one time that matters that I'm good at. It's basically training until I can't fail. And with the fire service, especially as a training officer, one of the things that I like to teach people is that you should not be training until you can do it correct. You should be training until you cannot get it wrong. And that's what we need to do ourselves. Again, don't rise to the level of expectations. We are going to fall to the level of our training. And training is all about all of this. So we have to continue to build on this and discuss this more with our colleagues. There's a lot to talk about on this topic, but this simple strategy that we're going over here can have some major implications. We have to understand that stress impacts our body, and so we use tactical breathing, we employ Hicks' Law, we use cognitive offloading, we practice with stress inoculation, we recognize our limitations, and by all means, we have to train. But if we use what lies between our ears, and we simulate as much as possible, we can use these strategies to become better. Shared mental models are huge, and after-action reviews are all important to learn from the past experiences to improve on future performance. We can always do better, and we should always be able to strive to do our best. But again, through all of us, we can accomplish this as a team. We shouldn't have to rely on basically us doing this all by ourselves, because really, this is all about a teamwork approach. Last time we talked about how to be a resuscitationist, and part of something I didn't really stress as much is that we have to do the teamwork. So this is my assignment that I want for you, is I want you to go forth and I want you to practice this. Do this as much as possible. Use that mental model. Think about this before and after your shifts. Before you go to shift, listen to a podcast. Think about what you would do in that scenario, because they're going to talk about different things. Then afterwards, after your shift, as you're going home, think about the cases you've seen that day. Think about those one or two cases that you know probably could have done better in some way, because always, inevitably, there's something we could have improved. Think about that. Build off of it. Don't stress about it. Don't spend hours dreading all the stuff that you could have done better. I don't want you to do it that way. What I want you to do is simply think about things you could have improved on. Make that mental simulation happen so that next time during the next stressful event, you're more mentally prepared. All right. Thank you all for this. Please let me know your feedback, because I want to be able to do this more and more. Luckily, recently, we've had a lot of excellent feedback, and I have some ideas for some upcoming podcasts. You may all be tired of hearing my voice by now, and I promise I'm working to change that. As I warned you guys a couple months ago, is that I'm going through a move, and so it's hard to get great internet. That's hopefully going to change here really soon. I'm going to have some people I'm going to interview, and we're going to expand off of this. But basically, what I would like you guys to do, in addition to what I've asked you just a second ago, please get on iTunes. Let's work on those 5-star ratings. Let's boost this up, because a lot of people, we've had a huge amount of press and increasing our downloads and stuff like that. It's awesome, but I just want to push it a little bit further. So if you could, please go into iTunes. It's also in the show notes. Go to there, and if you can't find me right away, if you search Total EM, it should pop up pretty quickly, and you can go there. If you're already subscribed, this may be the issue. So you search Total EM, you go there, and then you should be able to leave a 5-star review once you go to the podcast that way. Hopefully that's one of the things they change in the future. I'm not sure though. But again, leave that 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. Let me know if I'm not worthy yet of that 5-star review what I can improve on so we can get it great. But otherwise, until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere. Thank you for downloading another episode of Total EM. We want to thank our bandwidth sponsor, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this show. You can also see them on our website, but we also have included links to their website, funnyrx.com. Again, thank you, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this episode.